Hi, this is Rob Miller from Distillery Lane Cider Works. We're about an hour north of Washington, D.C. in Frederick County, Maryland, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 117. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. This is Rhea Windcaller, the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week, our featured guests are the folks at Distillery Lane Cider Works outside of Fredericks, Maryland. That's both Rob Miller and Tim Rose. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. If you are a new listener to Cider Chat, welcome. And if you're a regular listener, hey, good to see you kind of virtually. I'm imagining you right now with a glass of cider or, you know, digging in the scene with a gangsta lean, kind of listening as you go about your work. And I do hear that folks do listen to this podcast doing all kinds of fun stuff, primarily bottling cider or pruning trees. That just makes my heart soar. But if you want to get right to the Distillery Lane chat, you might want to scroll ahead. But in between all that, I got some good news around Ciderville. But before I get there, let me remind you that last week, instead of a podcast, I posted on the Cider Chat YouTube channel the PowerPoint and audio from Dale Brown, who is one of the managing partners at Cider Market LLC. I kind of consider it like a think tank website for so many cider resources. So you want to check that website out. And that's a very informative video because it's talking about the cider market and cidery community in the U.S. And now you might be an international cider maker or drinker out there. And I think you'll get value from this too, because for me, I don't just cover the U.S. I like to talk to everybody around the world because it's all intrinsically linked together for making cider where it is today. So you can't just look at one community separately and stay kind of monocultured in the world of cider, at least not in my experience, because the apple keeps on rolling around the world. So check that out. You have to go to the YouTube channel, although you could go to Cider Chat and just see it as a blog posting. I don't really consider myself a blogger, even though I do the work of a blogger by always adding show notes. I really consider myself to be a podcaster. And I wear that proudly, kind of an indie podcaster, meaning that I am a solo and staring at a monitor and talking to you, oftentimes with a cider alongside me. So I want to catch you up on some news, but before I do, I want to, you know, last week worked out really well not having to speak on the podcast because I don't think I would have. So this is a little sad news for me. But the weekend before, on the 17th, I was headed out to Nine Pins Gathering of Ciders. It was in Albany, New York. And heading out the door, and I got a phone call from my dear friend, Laura B., who was taking care of my giant dog, Tucker. He Yeah, you're getting the end of the story already, right? A Grape Pier and Marimba mix. So Grape Pier is from the French Pyrenees and Marimba is from the Italian Pyrenees. Whew, I'm already crying. I'll be right back. Okay. So what happened in short was Tucker was with Laura and Dale out hiking that day. They were at an early sunrise hike, and that big old dog went into some kind of crisis. We don't really know what put him down, but instead of going out to the Albany event, I had to turn around and go into, I don't know, mega cruise, setting up a rescue mission backcountry. Tucker was off trail. They were away in the woods on like this kind of, I'm going to call it like a 400, 600 acre backcountry mountain scene, because where else would you send your Grape Pier for the weekend except to friends who have the backyard of a mountainside at their disposal? Anyways, Tuck was in crisis, and we had to kind of bring him down off the mountain and had to set up a makeshift stretcher. Some of Dale's friends showed up, these big guys on ATVs. I hopped on one of the ATV, and you know, everybody's ramped up. I learned a lot about kind of rescues now. And one is slow things down, because this kind gent was cruising up the mountaintop. I was trying to get to Tucker to see what was going on, and he's going a little too, you know, it was tough terrain to travel on. Anyways, the ATV kind of flipped. You recall, I had shoulder surgery. Of course, I landed on my right side. My shoulder was, it just kind of goes on and on. And not to like go into every single detail, but in the end, that dog died a warrior's death. We brought him down the mountain, and he didn't make it. Later that day, I was able to, we were able to break some ground on my property and put him in. And miraculously, what happened was so cool, which, you know, just tells you that there's magic in the world. When this dog came into my life, I was dogless. I didn't even have any animals, actually. I was kind of on the cusp of a relationship going downhill. And these two angels came in, one being this giant dog who, you know, 140 pounds is what I would consider a giant dog, and a little white cat. Both came into my life in 1 week. Tucker found me walking in the woods. He was essentially either dumped or something like that, and followed me home. And I was a little like, oh, should I take this big giant dog? Because what I wanted was a Chihuahua, believe it or not. I was, at that point, traveling a lot and thinking, I want like a little, you know, purse dog that I could bring on the plane with me. And so my joke was always constantly, instead of getting a Chihuahua, I got Wawa, the biggest dog in Siderville, it felt like. And as we were ready to lower him in to his final resting spot, now, mind you, I live in a pretty remote area of Siderville on a dirt road. You know, I can't see my neighbors. It's kind of just like the way I like it, really. And there's, when I got the property, there was a giant school bus on the property. So I have this like cool school bus that I use for storage. And wouldn't you know, everybody's back was to the school bus, and I was facing the bus, and I looked down on the ground, and there is, walking towards all of us, a Chihuahua wearing an orange jacket with fur around its hood. I mean, what? It was crazy. It turned out to be some neighbors that were walking who had a visitor, and this woman never says, let's go for a walk, and they did. It was just kind of like this synchronicity moment where they were meant to be there. This Chihuahua came right up to Tucker, who was deceased, and just sniffed and smelled, and whoo, it just opened my heart. So I lost my flock guardian. The orchard's a little quiet, and I needed a week off. So that's what happened for me. I don't like to kind of like hang on too much sadness with all of you, but that's the way it goes sometimes, right? We lose beings, and we have to find the silver lining. I know a lot of folks out there in Siderville, you know, you're up against difficult things sometimes. You know, if you're trying to make business, whether you are a cider writer, which is really hard work, you know, do you get paid? Probably not. Yet you're like working your ass off. You might be thinking about your starting up a cidery. That's hard work. You know, you could feel like you're just shooting at stars and giving up a lot of your life. And even if you make it in business, life is always, sending these curveballs our way. And yet, we have to keep on getting up. And so, in times like this, I always am grateful for all my life experiences and knowing how to go through transitions well. And that's a little bit about what we do out there in Siderville, isn't it? Is to transform one liquid into another amazing liquid. And this experience with Tucker, it was an amazing time. I miss my big dog, and I'm just trying to transform it. So that was no podcast, and yet I'm going to try to move on. So when I come back, let me catch up with a little bit of news, and then we'll be heading to our main chat with Distillery Lane. Holy smokes. Oh, I don't know if that was cathartic or just like freaking a waste of time, but I had to talk about that through the encouragement of many people who know me. So thanks, buddies. Anyways, let's move on to some news. I've been hearing from people and I wanted to share all this like cool stuff that's happening out there in Ciderville. So first we're going to go up to British Columbia, and I heard from Day Cider, which is that is the handle on the Instagram page, and this chap wrote saying that he listens to the podcast as much as he can, thanking for the podcast, and they are based in Okanagan, British Columbia, and he was hoping to take the cider course in Oregon University in July. But right now, they have 85 acres of organic pears. It is the largest pear availability in Western Canada. Can you imagine looking out at 85 acres of pear trees? Whew. Well, that flips me out. I'm not seeing any peri pears there. They have Bartlett, Bosque, Green, and Red du Jour. Red Diageur pears. They're making cider, and they're doing a mix of all these varieties. They've pressed the Bartletts separately, and he says that, or writes, that the juice is something to talk about. So this pear orchard has been farmed by this family for 120 years, and they thought, why not try to create some great ciders with these beautiful pears? So we're going to like stay in touch with this craft pear farm and see what's going to be happening. I mean, 120-year-old pear trees, 85 acres. That is good news, Ciderville. And as Perry Pear would say, for Perryville too. So that was from Day Cider. And then I also heard from a guy by the name of Sam Perry. I wonder if he knows what the root of the surname Perry is. Sam, if you don't, you should listen to Marilyn's Got Palms. Perry Pear talks all about your last name, but maybe you have more info. Anyways, Sam Perry is a part of this new cider bar cidery in, I mean, this is kind of interesting to me because you don't think about this as an area, but it's in Mancos, Colorado. Now, if you know the Four Corners region, that is Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico, and you're just talking about big sky, beautiful, oh man, country that is just so great. You know, I've driven out there, been out there many times. You just want to jump out of your car and just start running, kind of like a reverse Arctic hysteria, but in a sane way. So this place is called Fence Line Cider because they figure, you know, all the best little apple trees that were in touch were always along a fence line. This area also was known to have a lot of heritage apples, so who knew? Southwest Colorado is happening. They just opened up this cider house. It's, again, called Fence Line. You could check it out. They had their opening party on February 24th. So that just happened. That's Fence Line. Then we have another cidery. That is the Grand Illusions. That's in Pennsylvania, down a little bit to the west of Harrisburg. And Dr. Chad, he opened that up. That sounds like a really fun cidery that just took place. And then I heard from one other person from Atlanta, and I'm talking Atlanta, Georgia, and that is the Urban Tree Cidery. I heard from Tim, who wrote, he said, I'm sorry for discovering you so late in the game. Man, I'm not sorry at all, Tim. I'm stoked that you discovered Cider Chat, no matter when or where we get connected, as long as we get connected. And he also wrote, I had no idea there was an advocate like you out there for the cider industry, which just made me blush up and down and gave me such a good, warm, fuzzy feeling. Tim is the owner and the head cider maker for Urban Tree Cidery based in Atlanta, Georgia. And I don't know a lot about Urban Tree. I haven't had any of their ciders. And though he writes that they are an orchard-based cidery. So that's great. And he listens to the podcast while he is pruning or while he is making a cider. And I'm really happy to hear that based upon listening to this podcast, he heard about Adam Levy, the alcohol professor, and he did submit his ciders to the New York International Beer Competition. So I haven't seen the results yet. They are not yet out, but well, bully for you. I hope you get some kind of placement there, a good medal placement and some good feedback, which sometimes is even more important than any kind of dang medal. So there you have it. Good news out there in Sarderville. It is the yin and yang of the world, and we have to take it as it comes, don't we, and learn how to move through it. So we're going to next move to Distillery Lane Ciderworks and my chit-chat there. So I'll be right back and give you a little bit of upfront on that and get right into that chat. I have to confess, I do not know too much about Maryland. But, of course, doing episode 112, called Maryland's Got Palms, well, I learned a bit about its history with apples and pears. And then I followed up with episode 115 after being in Baltimore, and I produced Baltimore Speaks Cider. So I'm feeling like I know a little bit more about Maryland than I've had the chance to do over the course of my entire life. So that just goes to figure that, you know, there's always an opportunity to learn about Ciderville. And one of those opportunities happened on a morning in February, or actually it was January, when I was able to visit Distillery Lane Ciderworks. So let's all grab a glass and head over and speak with both Rob Miller and Tim Rose of Distillery Lane Ciderworks. And I'm asking Rob here to give us a little bit about the background of this cidery.
I've had a winery license, a Maryland winery license and a federal winery license for about 7 years now. Mm-hmm. We planted our first trees 17 years ago, so it took forever and a day to grow the trees, get the fruit going, and then of course we thought it would be much easier than it turned out to be to get licenses, and then we had to build buildings, and you know that all that process took much longer and a lot more money, of course, than we ever thought. But it, you know, for now 7 or 8 years, going into our 8th year of production and sales of hard cider. In terms of acres, we have, I think, 11 acres of apples right now, and this coming spring we'll add one more acre. So, and then I think we're sort of capped out in terms of the production facility that we have now and storage facility. We could add more fruit, but then it adds a whole other dimension of, well, you need more buildings and more coolers and, you know, all of that to go up to the next level. And we're pretty good right now.
When I arrived on that blustery January 31st day at Distillery Lane, I had a little peek out at the orchard, and I noticed that most of the trees appeared to be a semi-dwarf. So I asked if that was true of all their trees at the cidery.
We started out with semi-dwarf trees when we did our first planting, and now as we take things out or add new things, we're going to a dwarfing rootstocks. They're easier to prune and to train and to manage. But of course, they are four times as many trees to the acre, so you have four times the upfront cost to put them in. But I think in retrospect, if I had to do it all over again, I probably would have done dwarfing rootstocks entirely. But then you have to trellis the whole orchard, and it's just because they're not as self-supporting as a semi-dwarf tree. So it's always these trade-offs, and of course, money is always a factor too.
Always a factor.
Yes.
No money, no funny, no cider, no drink. sure is, dear. Are you like a Maryland native? You know, because let's talk a little bit about the landscape out here. You know, how the heck did you get out here driving up? It's like this massive, like, field area, farmland, just absolutely beautiful, rolling hills, open fields. Are you native to Maryland, or are you just kind of picked this? Well,
we've lived in the area. My wife and I have lived in the area for 35 years, and we used to live down in D.C., and we always wanted to sort of move out to the country when we were living there, and you know, we'd go to Virginia and on the weekends and check it out. We had come up here on a weekend. We had young children at the time, and we were doing pumpkin picking, and it was just one of those beautiful fall weekends. You know, the terrain here is nice rolling hills and just beautiful, lots of woodlands, and the Appalachian Trail goes by. So it's just one of those perfect fall days.
Up in the mountain? Because yes. There's a mountain range right behind us. So, you know, driving here, you're all fields, and then it looks like Distillery Lane is kind of almost abutting this mountain range.
Or? Yeah, northeast southwest.
Southwest. Okay.
Tim is a geologist by training, so he can tell you everything you want to know about the terrain.
Oh, good. That's really key for cider making, landscape. Knowing about soil and all that. Absolutely.
Yes. Cool. So anyhow, we had come up in this beautiful fall day, and the kids did all the pumpkin pay ride thing, and then we go home. And I was always a big auction fan, and I was reading the Washington Post on Sunday evening, the auction section, and here's this historic farmhouse for auction with this acreage. And I said to my wife, I said, this sounds like, you know, right where we were at. And of course, this was, you know, doing the pumpkins. This was back in the day of maps. So I find my atlas and dig it out. And it turned out we were like 4 or 5 miles from here. And the state of Maryland had bought this property from the heirs of the fellow who had farmed it for years and years, and they were going to make it into a subdivision. Mm-hmm. So the state bought it and put easements on it. There's a historical easement, an agricultural easement, and then they put the property up for auction. And it actually, it took the state a long time to do it, so it sat vacant for years.
Wow.
And sort of got a little bit run down. And we bought it at an auction 3 weeks later, so it was kind of
wow.
And the reason we could do that was because all the buildings and the land were all leased. The only thing we had to really contend with was the house, which was a beautiful house, old farmhouse. So we bought that, and then we lived here for a few years thinking about what we might do on the property, and we wanted to do some kind of value-added product, and I think there were 4 apple trees on the property, and we liked hard cider, and we started looking into it, and, you know, one bad decision followed another. We started with a few trees the first year, and then more and more, and you need a building, and bigger tractors, you need equipment, you need a cider maker. But it's really been great. We love it here. It's just beautiful country. Almost this entire area here, this farm is 100 acres, and all of the surrounding farms are in what's called the agricultural easement. So Maryland has been great on preserving farmland, so you won't see, you know.
This farm couldn't be resold as a subdivision. Is that true?
Okay,
so it's protected.
It's protected.
Let's just talk about the distance from different metropolitan regions. We're in Maryland right now, so we were talking earlier, it's about an hour and a half from Maryland.
To Baltimore. We're sort of equidistant between Baltimore and D.C. So it's somewhere, depends on how fast you drive. I could make it in an hour to either place, but probably get tickets. Then in a normal drive, it's somewhere an hour and 15, an hour 30 minutes to either Baltimore or D.C.
Depending on the time of day. Yeah, no doubt. Great. So that's a really nice situation for a cidery to be so close to a large population of people who are probably pretty thirsty, or if not curious, for cider. So I'm wondering, you get folks coming in on the weekend. How do you explain? Do they come in saying what is cider, and how would you say cider is? How would you finish that sentence?
You know, cider is we tell them it's sort of like a wine, because we do have a winery license. So it's fermented like a wine. We talk them through that process, and then we explain the difference. You know, some are dry and still, some are sparkling and off dry. We don't really make a sweet product.
I like to say to customers, think dry white wine. So they're prepared for not sweet and, you know, kind of tart. So, so that's what I like to tell them. And usually they say, great. We don't like sweet. That's really, really common.
Yeah. I think that's rather forward-thinking because you're not beating around the bush. You're setting the example for the consumer on what to expect and also on cider. So I think that's really brilliant that you're doing that. Good, good.
Well, probably at least half the customers that come in on a weekend have sought us out because they've had ciders before and they've read about us and they mm-hmm. say, well, you know, let's go out to the country for a drive and, mm-hmm. and try a dry cider. And,
right.
You know, we don't like sweet, or we want to just want to expand. You know, there's so many ciders out there and so many styles, and they're all good. It's just like I encourage people to go and visit the other cideries in the area. Just, you know, there's something for everybody, and it depends on what food you're eating too. Mm-hmm. You know, and what day it is. And
what's the next closest cidery to your location?
Really just about 2 or 3 miles from here is a new cidery.
Willow Oaks.
Called Willow Oaks. And we get people that'll come out and visit us. They'll go there. They'll go over to Middletown, which is about 4 or 5 miles here. There's a meadery there.
Mm-hmm.
It's excellent mm-hmm. meads. And then right over the mountain, mm-hmm. another 4 or 5 miles is a really big winery, big cork mm-hmm. winery. So mm-hmm. you can come out, you can go to a winery, a meadery, a couple cideries, and make a day of it. That's often what people do.
Perfect.
One thing I was learning about Fredericks County, Maryland, is that this is a very nice destination location. In fact, the more cideries you have, the more fun it is to head out in that hood and try out their ciders. You know, Willow Oaks, they also have heirloom apples. It says they have about 35 acres. I'm not sure how many of that is planted. And they're doing barrel aging and wild ferment. So talk about a good time. Well, let's head back to this conversation with both Rob Miller and Tim Rose as they start speaking about the kind of apples that they're growing at Distillery Lane.
When we established the orchard, the idea was we were going to make hard cider. So a lot of the varieties are very cider specific. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not for eating out of hand or mm-hmm. not for desserts. And probably a third of the orchard are those varieties that are just for ciders. Things like Tremlett's Bitter or Bulmer's Norman or the Kingston Black, mm-hmm. Porter's Perfection, some of the Bitter Sharp apples that are mm-hmm. really prized cider apples. They're really a pain to grow.
Say more about that.
Well, like I tell people about the Kingston Black, I mean, it makes a wonderful cider, probably my personal favorite. And I would have an entire orchard of just those trees, but for the fact that the trees don't grow straight, they're prone to disease, and best of all, they're biennial bearers, so they mm-hmm. fruit every other year. Other than that, they make a fine apple. And that is actually true of a lot of the bitter sharps. And we have learned the hard way over the years, you know, we've torn out plantings and of things that just didn't do well. So it's very hard, you know, apples can be very location specific. It's very hard to know, you know, how some English or French cider apple or even an old American apple is going to do in this particular climate.
You had some that were disease vectors as well.
Yeah, some of them that we, what it turned out once we tore them out, they were the source of disease or blights that were affecting other sections of the orchard.
Right.
So now we've learned our lesson. We're sort of planting fewer at a time. Mm-hmm. And we've got some nice sorts. So we have about a third of the orchard is, you know, bittersweets and bitter sharps. Another third of the orchard's a lot of old American apples that were actually used for cider. Mm-hmm. So we one of the ones that grows well, very well here was the Roxbury Russet. It's high in flavor, it's high in sugar, it's a great keeper.
Do you get a lot of russeting on your Roxbury Russet?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And Ashmead's Kernel, Golden Russet, and then the
Newtown.
The Newtown Pippins, Jefferson's favorite apple.
Yeah.
It does pretty
Thomas
good.
Jefferson, that is.
Thomas Jefferson. that tree took forever to get established, but now it's a wonderful apple, and we've added some more of those. So
great.
And then another third of the orchard are apples that are good for fresh cider, good for eating out of hand, or culinary apples.
Yeah.
We've got a British apple called the Bramley Seedling. It's, mm-hmm. you know, as the Americans, we grew up with Granny Smith and Red Delicious. The Brits grew up with this Bramley Seedling. It's a wonderful apple, my favorite for pies.
Great. So you're elevation here is, you know, people think Maryland and, you know, well, you know, what's the apple scene here? And then I kind of discovered, like, there is quite a bit of apple and Perry, you know, history in Maryland itself. So your actual elevation, because it's kind of farmland and all that, is very conducive for apple growing, because we're up here in January, end of January, tail end of January, and it's cold out. I mean, it's cold. Is this a classic cold that you would have? This is kind of unusual, isn't it?
No, this is, I mean, for January and February, this is fairly typical.
This is okay. Yeah. About 30-something degrees out there.
Yeah, for the high for the day. I mean, it might be it might be a little bit lower than maybe a high of 40 for the day. But,
okay.
You know, it's that 20 to 40 degree range.
A heat wave up for New England, where I'm from. You know, I'm like, oh.
And the cold, we don't mind that much. It's the wind, you know, when you're trying to prune
the
tree.
Stuff.
We do the dormant pruning this time of the year, and the wind will just rip right through you.
So wind is pretty common out here. You got so much open space, so it makes sense
it
a bit.
Yeah, comes out off the mountain.
Yeah.
So the soils here are very, that was one of the reasons we went to apples, and we have a nice sandy loam soil, which is I think, a good soil for apples.
Great. So you went commercial in 2007. Your ciders are available regionally, coming here, of course, because you have a beautiful tasting room and set up, very welcoming, nice presentation, super inviting place to drive into. Definitely worth that. And where else would folks be able to find your ciders out in the world?
Throughout Maryland, Baltimore, of course, and in D.C. So we distributed both those. We had been into Virginia and West Virginia and Pennsylvania, but our true markets are close markets. You know,
okay.
It's everybody is, you know, emphasizing local, and it works well for us to sell.
Cool. Now, you are the cider maker. How did you guys meet, and how long have you been working here at Distillery Lane?
So we met about 10 years ago, I would say, when I saw an article in the newspaper about a local beer club coming up here and helping pick apples. And then there was this list of apples in the orchard, and I'm going. So I had been making cider in the basement for about 7 or 8 years prior to that, perfecting the method, right?
Yeah,
and
good luck with that.
Good luck with that when you can't get the right apples.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that is one thing that we say around here, is it's all about the apples.
Yeah.
And so when I saw the names of those apples, which I knew from, you know, studying, I went, holy cow, I got to go up there. And I got on the phone like that evening, and it was actually Bill, your dad, that answered the phone. And I said, can I come up and get some juice? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, want me to bring some cider too? And he said, sure. And so I did. And I came up and volunteered a little bit, bought some juice for a few years. And, you know, as many amateur cider and beer makers think, you know, maybe one day you could professionally pursue this. And anyway, you know, don't wish too hard, because you don't know what you might be getting into.
What do you mean? Wait a minute, man. We're not going to let that go.
It worked out really well for me, because my two daughters were off to college, and I had free time for, you know, no more 6 sporting events per weekend with 3 kids, and so I finally had free time for about a month and a half, and then
We grabbed them. So, and from our side of the story is, you know, although we just opened as the winery 7 years ago, we were selling fresh apples and fresh cider, and then juice to homebrewers. And Tim was among this group of homebrewers who would come up here and buy the juice all the time. And these homebrewers would all then bring us a bottle. Hey, Rob, try this. Hey, Rob, try this. Here's a couple of bottles, which we encouraged and enjoyed. And so as we were getting close to opening, getting our licensing in place, Patty said, you know, we really need some help on the cider making side of it, because we were admittedly, you know, doing that all,
you know, bravo for you, because I just want to stop there, because I know a lot of cideries didn't do that, and they jumped to it and they started producing cider and put out a product that was a little bit less than average, especially in the past more recent years. So I think really bravo for you to like admit that to yourself. That's a kind of a key factor, isn't it, saying, I need some help here. Let's go to that next level.
Yes, and you've got so many things going on. I mean, you're growing trees. You're trying to figure out how to sell. You're filling out tax forms and you know, all that stuff. And so, anyhow, my wife, as we were talking about it, she said, "Why don't you call that Tim guy? He always makes a good cider." So, you know, of all the samples that people would drop off, we like those. So I called that Tim guy, and he came out. And,
Tim guy sitting right here.
He's sitting 7 years later. He's still here wondering what was he thinking.
All right. So, Tim, you learned, as I do, you know, non-commercial cider maker, doing that. And then you came on, became commercial. What was the difference there for you, going from, like, small batch to much larger batch? Is that, like, the kind of classic?
Scaling up is not as straightforward as one would think. You know, suddenly you have to worry about things like carbon dioxide buildup inside the building and many, many other things. Having access to these apples is the most crucial part. And so we've been learning, you know, over the years, and we continue to learn what blends of apples produce the best ciders. And we have some pretty set formulas now. But it's really, you know, it's really those fruit that they got great advice on planting early on, especially the bittersweets and the mm-hmm. bitter sharps.
Yeah, so that set the platform
crucial
for a really good senior at Distillery Lane. So let's talk about some of the ciders that you make and maybe some cider making techniques, because you have a number of single varietal ciders, right?
A few, yeah, we do. We make, actually right now we have three different versions of Kingston Black single varietal. We have a still from last year, I believe, and then we have a bourbon barrel aged one, which is still, and we have, so that's four actually. We have a forced carbonated off dry version, mm-hmm. and we have a bottle conditioned fully dry version. So actually, right now we have four different Kingston Black single varietal ciders, and they're all a little bit different. They're from different years, but that lets you know right there some of the different styles. We also make petalant cider, which is just barely carbonated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our scrumpy is that way right now, mm-hmm. and it's lightly bottle conditioned. Mm-hmm. We also make ciders with other fruit, but primarily we're just apple cider. Some of those fruit are the aronia berries that Rob, I'm sure, will love to tell you about. We make two ciders with that.
Mm. When did you start working with the aronian berries?
It was a cold winter day like now where we weren't working a few years ago, and I'm catching up on back issues of Lancaster Farming magazine. And there's this front page article about this super berry called aronia, the old chokeberry.
Yeah.
And this is pretty interesting. That, you know, the deer don't bother it. It's completely disease resistant, and it's really super high in tannins, and it's got this astringent taste.
Highest antioxidant fruit mm-hmm. that there mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm.
So I called up the author of the article. It was from University of Maryland, and said, "Hey, tell me a little bit more about this." And he said, "Well," he said, "you can't really eat them on their own, or they're really bitter." He said, "But if you could get some kind of juice to blend it with, like maybe cider," he said, "you know, maybe you could do something." It's like, "Well, I just happen to have a little access to some cider." So my wife and Tim still joke, because I was looking then online. I had to buy some of these plants. You know, I'm looking on Amazon, and you can buy potted plants for like $20 a pop. And I found this, you can buy a pallet from the Midwest. There's like 330, I think, plants, and they were only $1 or $2 a piece if you bought the entire pallet. Well, I say, you know, the cheap German farmer I am, I got to buy the pallet, right? So, of course, we did a planting then that next spring of 330, you know, 6-inch high plants, and as predicted, within the first year they grew a couple of feet, and now they're 5 feet tall. They're great producers, and
you're growing it right here on the property.
We're growing right here on the property. It's the only thing besides apples that we grow. And we use those in two ciders. They're used in a cider we make for a really nice farm-to-fork restaurant in Baltimore called Woodbury Kitchen. And we, rather than call it the cider aronia berry cider or chokeberry cider, as the common name, just didn't seem to, I don't think it would fly off the shelf very much, called chokeberry.
Yes.
So we called it the Woodbury cider, and it's got a small percentage of it, and it gives it this nice little bite to it.
Is it difficult working with that berry at all? Is there any kind of peculiarities that you find?
There are, but they can be overcome. The most important thing about them is they have a different kind of astringency from the tannin in the apples. So it has a different finish. And, of course, the color, the incredibly intense rich color of Aronia juice goes a long way.
Would you describe that color?
It's almost opaque. The juice is almost opaque. It's that dark. It's a really, really dark, dark red.
Would you say purple? Yeah, purple.
I have some great pictures on our Facebook page of when we press it. This purple juice running down.
Cool. And then they use it for dyeing.
They do. And at the end of the day, you know, we all, and the next few days, we all have purple fingers because it, you know, it gets onto your skin. It doesn't come right off.
Turns your tongue blue when you eat berries.
So how do you deal with the astringency with that in the blending in it?
Go easy. The Aronia wine, which we have made, you know, straight up Aronia wine, is variously described as tasting like beet juice. I think it has a sort of a pomegranate flavor, actually. I think the berries have kind of a pomegranate flavor, which goes along, I guess, with the flavor that comes from the antioxidant. Mm-hmm. You just go easy with them.
We did a second cider, too, which we called the Witch's Brew, in which we added a higher concentration of the Aronia, but rather than Tim and I being the ones who decided what that finished product would taste like, we were often in the tasting room on a Sunday afternoon. We'll have three different versions of it, and we'll have the customers decide. Because one thing we've learned over the years, too, is what the two of us think is a fine cider may not be what the public likes, you know, to just... you should love this because this, we won an award with this.
The public just doesn't know yet.
They've got to learn. We've learned there.
Yeah. So are you putting the Aronia berry in at primary fermentation, or are all right.
So when we did those tests, of course, it was blending the other way.
But you found it best to go primary.
Together.
Now how about wild ferment here?
We generally don't do a wild ferment. Every once in a while we might have one by accident, but
I'm kind of a control freak.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I would rather know what I'm going to get in 250 or 500 or 1,000 gallons. Our wild yeast, we've done some experiments, tends to not flocculate well. And so I guess if we wanted a cloudy cider, intentionally we might try that. Other than that, I like to use the guys that I know the best.
Just for listeners who don't know what flocculate means, can you explain that cider or kind of wine?
It's sort of the characteristic of yeast to drop out of the cider and clear. We like the cider to clear as much as possible, so we don't have to do as much filtration as we might have to.
So do you actually, you're sitting right next to your filter right here, right? So that's what you're doing for your ciders.
Well, as we've evolved, we tend to do more and more filtration, I think.
For clarity, but for also
really,
for bottle
really for clarity and for stabilization.
That's
what it's all about. Early on, we barely filtered anything. Mm-hmm. We just let it drop clear on its own and bottle it up like that.
And the cider conference is in Baltimore this week.
Yeah.
And they'll have all these sessions there. And I can guarantee you pretty much that the two most well-attended sessions there will be on filtration and yeast. It's just that there'll be a crowd standing out into the hall because, you know, that's what all the cider makers are interested in, whether you're a beginner or an experienced one.
Yeast is a big dictator there in it. You know, you really change it. Yeah.
And there's a lot of research going into yeast now. And so we've been playing around with some of the newer yeast with great success. And so it's fun to watch what they're going to come up with next. And it's nice to have volumes of juice to do experiments on. Mm-hmm.
And there are wonderful ciders with wild yeast fermentations. Our collaborative this weekend, the folks at Big Hill did a wild yeast fermentation, and it's a terrific cider. It's just, you know, there's so many styles and of cider.
There aren't so many styles. That's right.
And you know, just ours is we stick to what we know. And Tim,
I like the consistency.
Yes, Tim being Tim is a scientist, and you know, so we have data on individual apples, the you know, all through the fermentation, mm-hmm. and information on different yeasts for different ciders at mm-hmm. different times of the year, the fermentation done.
So you got it.
So
yeah.
You know, we try to stay with what we know. And then not that we don't experiment, but
we do.
We do a lot.
When we send kegs down to the restaurants in downtown Baltimore and D.C., I want to have some confidence that somebody who's had it 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or 6 months ago and orders a celebration cider on draft is going to have a celebration cider that is reminiscent of what they had before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's never going to be exactly the same.
Right, because you have vintages, really.
That's
you know,
right.
In
that's
cider.
Right. And I don't mind that change.
It's not like beer that way that you can make it so, and even beer it changes too, where it can be so consistent, but yeah.
Yeah, we can't, I guess, be that consistent because, you know, that's
the beauty
a very
of
controlled recipe, but yeah. And that's actually one of the things that Rob touts about the fresh cider is they press different apples every week. And so we tell folks, come back next week and it's going to be different.
Well, let's talk about that. When are you pressing and do you stop pressing? Or are you making cider all year long? What is your rotation there?
We start selling fresh cider and fresh apples the first weekend in September. Mm-hmm. And then we have apples through Thanksgiving. People start our fill it with pies by the time mm-hmm. December rolls around, so the fresh mm-hmm. apple sales trickle in after that. But we're actually still making fresh cider this year because we had a good apple that's a good keeper, and we're still having strong demand for fresh cider. But probably in the next couple of weeks, we'll do our last batches and wait till September of next year.
Okay. And your storage facility for it is?
In that other building across the street, we have more tanks. We have... Yep. We have three walk-in coolers that mm-hmm. accommodate, you know, mm-hmm. enough of our production that we can mm-hmm. stay ahead of it. When we laid out the orchard, in addition to these different apples and different baskets, we also had tried to stagger the ripening schedule. So we pick our first apples probably the first week in August, and this year we picked our last apples right after Thanksgiving. We do. So it's a very long ripening period, which a lot of these cider apples are late ripening. Although some are early, but it helps us, you know, that we're not overwhelmed by apples at one point. We're not overwhelmed having to press or with cold storage, mm-hmm. and that was one of the few things that mm-hmm. we did really right mm-hmm. correctly mm-hmm. when we planned the orchard.
So right now, what do you have out there conditioning in your tanks? A whole range of like a base cider that you blend in. And a couple single varietal ciders, or
so. There's a story we can tell you about barrel aging.
Yes,
you know, you read a lot about barrels and how they're very difficult to sanitize. And I think that oak and cider go together beautifully. And one of the first things I had to convince him of was that, in fact, yes, we can oak a cider and people will like it. And sure enough, they did. And our Jefferson cider is oak-aged and one of our gold medal-winning ciders. But we got contacted by a fellow at a distillery, a local distillery, and he wanted us to put cider in some of his barrels. Well, they were used bourbon barrels. And so I said to Rob, okay, sure, we can do that, but what do we get out of it? And, of course, I said that facetiously because what we get out of it is what comes out after we empty it and send the barrel back to them. Because what they wanted was the barrel to absorb essence of apple stuff. And, of course, we got the reverse, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Nice. Not only that, we get a barrel that's completely sterile because it's got whiskey residue in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we first did some batches with bourbon barrels, and we sent the barrels back. The idea is that they would then refill those barrels, which they had done with used port wine barrels. And the port wine barrels produce some kind of distillate. I don't know what you would call it, but tremendously popular, and they could sell at a premium, a very high premium. Mm-hmm. That was their idea, was to have us age the barrels with cider. And so then we tried it with rye whiskey barrels, and we're in an area that has a strong history of rye whiskey making from the late 19th and early 20th century. There were two distilleries right here. In fact, that's why we're called Distillery Lane. The Mountain Spring Distillery was just across the street here. And they produced a cider that they wanted to rival...
A whiskey.
A rye whiskey that they wanted to rival the other guy who was up the street at Needwood Distillery. His name was Outerbridge Horsey. And Horsey Rye is famous in history. But Horsey sent his cider around Cape... Cider. He sent his rye whiskey around Cape Horn to the West Coast and back across the Transcontinental Railroad and called it Golden Gate. And also that commanded a very high premium and was apparently very good. And the idea was that sloshing around in ships would age this rye whiskey more quickly. It goes through the tropics, it's getting heated up, sloshing around, comes back. We kind of figured the angel share was probably a little higher on that one because,
probably.
You know, you just don't know who was dipping in there.
Probably.
So J.D. Ahalt over here sent his to Rio and back, Rio de Janeiro and back. So it went through the tropics and came back.
Huh.
And so when
was
we got
there anything left? What kind of ship was that on? I sailed down there.
When we decided a name for our rye barrel aged cider, we chose Rio. Sort of honor the tradition that they had. And that's a beautiful off-dry sparkling rye barrel aged cider that's it's a fine thing.
Maryland has a long history of spirits production, especially
right.
whiskeys. It was all up until Prohibition, and then things went to the fell to the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
So, along with some cider production and a lot of apples grown in this whole Frederick County area and other areas of the state that were grown for cider production.
Well, I read that Lord Baltimore had made the decree in 1634 that everyone brings in kernels of cider and perry for production. And so, obviously, there's a Perryville in Maryland, there's a Hereford in Maryland. So the history of cider and pears are pretty long standing here, too. And so it's rather interesting. I don't think people really thought about that.
Yeah,
because Maryland could get a little bit lost on the map. That's not a cool thing.
Yeah.
We don't want that. We want Maryland on the map.
Absolutely.
Right? And you have a range of ciders, and they're sold in 750-mil bottles, I see here. What is your ABV that you're typically going at? Because you said wine. Are you going a little bit higher than
typically,
the classic ABV?
We're at somewhere in the range of 7 to 8% on all the ciders. Which
perfect.
Is the result of, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I mentioned earlier the russets, the Roxbury russet. You let those out. You pick them, and we learned this, you never press them when you pick them. They have to be in cold storage for a month or more because the sugars continue to develop and the flavors continue to develop. And, you know, a really nice ripe Roxbury russet will have a Brix of 16%. So it's going to be, an 8%+ finished cider. But if you blend that with a percentage of bittersweets apple that are lower in sugar, ultimately you sort of get to our target of the 7.5%.
And for some of our smaller batches, we bump that up by cryo-concentrating, freezing and partially thawing, and getting some rich concentrate that way. And we also make a sizer, which is 11%, and that's 10% honey.
And we did plant a couple of varieties that like the Wixen crab is thought to have a Brix of 22%. So
it's your finding?
No, ours has been, we are 16 to 18 this year. But the trees are just, it's only their second year of production. It's hard to judge exactly. You can't say that this is what this fruit's either going to taste like or going to be produced in the early years. We learned that.
Well, I think this is awesome. Today you're hosting a tour coming in from the United States Association of Cider Makers. There's a busload of 50 makers and people in the trade coming to tour your facility. Is that typical that you might get a bus tour coming in? Is that happening at this point?
we will get the occasional bus group out here. And so we'll split the group up in the different parts. And one part of it will do tastings. I'll do an orchard tour for the brave who are willing to go out and be a little chilly. And Tim will talk about
or depending on the time of the year. I mean, today it's chilly, but when another tour in the, you know, the fall is like perfect time to walk in the orchard. Who wouldn't love that?
Yeah. And we have in our orchard, we have a self-guided walking tour. And, you know, people would come in and they'd ask you questions about cider and, you know, how many apples do you have. So we decided to put all those on signs. So we have 18 golf course flags that go around the orchard. And at each flag, there's one sign with a couple of sentences or a paragraph with some fun fact about apples or
history.
Cider making.
And
history.
We even have geology.
Yes, because you're a geologist.
We have a couple of geology.
Which is really handy to know about what's going on with the soil. You know, that's key. That's absolutely key to cider production.
Yes.
It's a good skill to have.
Yes, being a geologist is a nice thing to have in your cider making a toolkit back pocket. And how about that idea of having flags, in this case golf flags, with little informational cider knowledge stops? I like that quite a bit. Of course, it was a little bit too cold for me to be out in that orchard that day. That wind out there was really, really something. And also, I'm sorry for that little background noise. There wasn't really any place for us to sit, so we kind of just saddled up next to the cooler, and that's what happens sometimes. So thanks again to both Rob Miller and Tim Rose for spending time today with us and giving us a little bit of background on Distillery Lane Ciderworks. If this podcast inspires you, well, please do consider helping this podcast stay on the air. And there's a lot of ways to do that. You could be a patron of Cider Chat. If you're a commercial maker, you could join the Cider Going Up campaign. And you could also do what Robbie Honda of Tanuki Cider Company in Santa Cruz, California did, which is he said, you know, geez, I've been listening to this for a while. I'm going to send Rhea a check equal to $2 per episode. So if you're enjoying a lot of Cider Chat and you want to keep this podcast on the air, please consider donating today. And if you have more questions, just send me an email to rhea@ciderchat.com. This is episode 117, and if you'd like to see some photos from my visit at a Distillery Lane Ciderworks, well, do go to that post at ciderchat.com. Again, that's episode 117, and there'll also be a photo of my pup, my dearly beloved Tucker. There are some good episodes coming up, and I can't wait to keep on rolling them out to you, Ciderville. So stay posted to that, and if you haven't subscribed yet to this podcast, please do. You don't want to miss anything out in the greater world of Ciderville, because there's a lot happening, and it's just not ending. In the meanwhile, I hope you have a good time between now and then. Safe journey. Hug those that you love, and make sure you hug those little pups and kitty cats and feathered furry creatures all around, because they are what make the world so grand, and to keep those little varmints out of the apple orchard, which is a good thing too. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I am looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!